From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, I'm going to call him first actor, writer, and sometimes comedian, Rami Youssef, is embarked on the third season of his show, Rami. How best to describe it? It's a show that from season to season, end it with a cliffhanger. I think, and I've said this to him before, this new season, every episode is its own cliffhanger. Rami, first of all, welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Every episode, we talked about this before, is its own cliffhanger in this way that you really ratcheted up the stakes in a way that you hadn't done it in previous seasons. And I want to have you talk about that because it's a really different take on what you've done with the show so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think like pretty early on, I think even going into season two, we had this debate, which was we had spent the season one kind of dealing with this character's kind of optimistic confusion and soul searching. And we felt like we could repeat that engine, but it would almost be, yeah, like the word repeat, right? And so that felt a little bit boring to us. I mean, I think I love comedies that have that type of formula, whether it be, you know, I mean, obviously Larry David does that so well across Curb and Seinfeld. And, you know, I think you can see that kind of pattern throughout sitcoms that came before that and came after it. And I think what we were interested in as we went into the second and now as we go into the third is looking at a character study and the more framing we continue to get around it, it's really his spiritual journey. You know, it's this guy's been seeking since we met him. And part of that seeking is kind of creating a bit of an ego death and the idea of who he wants to be, but who he actually is, continue to kind of reflect off each other and it gets a little bit more aligned in a place that is a tough reality for him. So for me, that influences what the seasons look like in the way that, you know, different years of someone's life could look like. And as we went into the third season, in the way that the character is navigating and learning, I just think for me, as someone making the show and feeling flexible with how the show looks and feels and is evolving, it was exciting to kind of look back at the previous 20 episodes and say, when am I having the most fun cutting the show? When am I having, you know, when we're in the edit? When am I having the most fun acting? You know, when am I having the most fun with what an episode looks like? And then how do we bring all of that into all the episodes that we're doing?
It's funny you're saying this because that opening of the first episode, which starts with him telling this anecdote, talking about how he ended up where he is in the Diamond District, and then the tag at the end of it is really the kind of the metaphor for what you're talking about, what he wants to be, what the way he wants to see the world versus the way the world actually is, just sort of between the really opposite poles of Rami and his uncle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like really beautiful thing. And then you realize he's saying it to close a sale, right? And I think that there is this reality, there's this, you know, this idealism, and then there's this reality of the situation that he's in. And it kind of echoes what I think is always been kind of a subtle theme of what this family is operating from. But I think in the third season, ideas of capitalism and kind of the type of person it can shape you into and the type of family it can shape you into are really present for us in the writing, but obviously in what the family looks like this season.
But that thing you're talking about, what you want to be versus what you actually are, I mean, because we look at what the first season was, which is introducing characters like his sister and his uncle as kind of like archetypes. And this season, we're seeing them as these people who force the archetypes whose feet are on the actual ground. And suddenly they're three-dimensional and these things that they try to will for themselves into being aren't really happening.
Part of the shift this season as well, like, is making it feel like more of an ensemble show where those archetypes get to have even more dimension, you know, and we continue to just expand into making room for more of the characters and more of the experiences, you know. So that's something that we were very excited about in getting to make a show for this long.
It's the treatment I'm talking about, the really exciting series, Rami, with its creator and star, Rami Youssef. It's going to see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And this thing that we've talked about even in the first season, but really has sort of come to land here, is often sitcoms are about anxiety. And this is a, I don't want to say sitcom, but it's a comedy series about fear and how people deal with that fear. And I just wonder, in thematic terms, what it's like to play that out, because it really, we sort of feel that sort of ego death you're talking about for all the characters, and that's kind of tragic and comic at the same time.
Yeah, and I think framing it in terms of fear is really, I love that. I love that that's what you're pointing out, because I think that that is at the core of almost any spiritual practice, which is, you know, don't put your fear in all this other stuff, just fear God, you know? And there's almost this acknowledgement in any spiritual practice, I think, that the idea of fear God is not to ignore that God is the source of love or God is a source of guidance. It's all of those things can be true, but the idea is really, you don't have to fear your boss so deeply. You don't have to fear what's going to happen to you in your life, because how much of that can you really control? The only thing you really have to fear is the unseen. And so why don't you live, you know, with as much love and as much balance and patience and all those things that we would kind of, you know, assign to a virtuous person, and take your fear out of, you know, everyone that you have around. And none of the characters in this show have achieved any of that, but I think they would like to have that. And we kind of see them grapple with the realities of how many things they're placing fear into and what that's doing to their inner lives and obviously very much their outer lives as well, and all those relationships.
That ego death you were talking about is also about these characters, several of whom seem to exist again as archetypes early on, coming to understand the contradiction in their lives, Rami's ache for this kind of spiritual enlightenment, but being trapped in the idea of pursuing momentary satisfaction. And these constant contradictions have really sort of landed in the season in ways that make us aware of all these tensions going on around the characters.
Again, when you get to make 20 episodes before this, there'll be times where I'll think, okay, cool, you know, I really love the feeling I got from this one episode, and this other episode, I love the feeling I had during certain parts. You know, you kind of just are doing research on your own thing. And I think that's what's, again, really fun, not just about TV, but I would even go specific to say streaming. I want to feel like I'm getting to use it as kind of this expansive playground for trying different things. And it feels like such a exciting part of getting to, you know, grow, writing, filmmaking, all those things that really excite me, right? When we did the Q&A, at one point you used the word dense, and I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, we could really put in a lot more than one would think. And I'm not someone who likes to save ideas. I really like to be like, yo, let's do it. If we've got it, let's do it. And then it'll just force us to think of more. And so you're kind of seeing the result of like just that excitement of, you know, we can really give everyone this inner life, and it almost feels like its own, you know, little movie. Or, you know, we made a show with Mo Ammer that isn't a spinoff of this, but it's so much because there's this window of how much he has to offer. And I think I love this cast so much because you watch any of these episodes and you see how deep that window is and how much they have to offer, where you're like, oh, I could watch a whole show with the mom. I could watch a whole show with the sister. I could watch a whole show with the white sheikh who's like peddling, you know, fake religion or whatever, you know, or maybe it's not fake. That'd be a good show, you know? So I think these windows can get so deep in a way that are really exciting for me.
Watching the show, just find myself thinking about this thing that the show does. And I know we talked about this when we did our first Q&A, which is a show that makes fun of people pursue a spiritual goal, but it doesn't make fun of spirituality, which is so often what happens in shows where you deal with characters who have a foundation of religion. These shows don't know how to deal with the fact that there is a reason that people look for enlightenment, their spiritual attachment. And we can feel that emptiness that's grown in Rami from season to season, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that, yeah, that was a big goal of how we set out to tell this story, you know, because I think that criticizing religion, the parody of religion, of religious cultures, of all of that, has been done a lot. And I think it's been very justifiable that a lot of that's been done and said. I don't think that, you know, the way modern religion moves is anything that anyone can find a ton of pride in. I think it's become kind of its own industry that works against everything it's preaching. So I'm not someone that can really stand behind the way what I would kind of call the industry of religion moves. You know, the way that industry moves is really dark. And I think it's kind of a bit of a plague on the whole world. That being said, the pursuit of the spiritual goals within that, the pursuit of a relationship with the unseen, the idea of having spiritual goals, these are things that I think everybody has. And I think that people have different versions of what they want to call it. They might want to put it into the container of, you know, Abrahamic language, but they also might want to take it out and put it into something else because of, again, the connotation of what's happened with that. All of that is to say that what these characters are after and how they're after it is just so deeply human and I think so deeply relatable. And I think that's what makes it funny, because there's such lofty, high expectations they have of themselves and of each other. And it's the higher that is, the funnier the fall is in the way that we look at it, without, again, making fun of that pursuit. Because I think that pursuit it's really real. It's almost like, why would you make fun of someone for being hungry? You know, of course they're hungry. And I think that the way that they're looking for this relationship with their higher selves, it just feels very real to me.
This gap between the pursuit versus, you know, landlocked reality is so, and that's why I keep going back to that very first scene in the beginning of episode 3. I mean, that really sort of so beautifully encapsulates where the show has been, but also where it's going.
Again, like I think in a way, the things that we're laying out, we've been doing from the beginning, you know, and I think that, you know, just getting to track it with more specificity again in a season 3 is just, it's cool. It's cool to step into and find all of those little crevices and nooks, you know.
What we're seeing so much in the season 2 is how much more confident you are as an actor. There's a bit of impatience that you had in the first season that's kind of gone now.
That's something that I definitely feel in terms of just even what the goal is. I think that, you know, obviously a first season I had acted before, but not on the level of, like, you know, having a show. and I think that getting to a third season, it's fun to kind of go into the writing and into the performing and saying, okay, we're playing ambition, we're playing salesman, and there's simmering anger under that as well. And there's also kind of this soul disconnection happening. So it was like 5 different things. And it's really fun to kind of say, well, what is this scene? Is this a scene where I'm putting on the schmooze to make a sale? Is this the scene where I am really showing that anger that's simmering under that other interaction, but we really didn't see it, and now we're going to see it? And I think we also definitely have a bit of desperation, a bit of numbness. There's a couple of things that I think we felt it'd be nice for me to get into a different pocket of. And it's something I talked about a bunch with my co-creator, Ari, too, especially going into season 3, where we were like, all right, let's peel back anger. You know, he's going to throw a punch, and let's step into that. And that's something I've just had fun playing all those different things in a way where just being confused and charming is also, you know, which I did a lot of in the first season, is fun. But again, whether it be with the performing, whether it be with the writing, no sense in, like, you know, being bored or being repetitive. Like, let's evolve, because the truth is, people and their stories are really complex, and they can have a lot of different shades and look a lot of different ways. And, you know, let's do that with the performances. Let's do that with the tone. Let's do that with the format.
We'll take a break. My guest, who's turned his fear of boredom into a terrific TV series, is Rami Youssef. The show is Rami, this third season. This is A Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. It's the treatment. We're giving away the game during the halftime with my guest, Rami Youssef, whose new season of Rami, third season is out now. There's so much to talk about because, again, it's, to me, this season is about achievement. You were hitting on it a little bit before we took the break, which is the specter of shame looms large over this season. And Rami's actions earlier come back to haunt him, and his sister's, her ambition versus her ability to realize those ambitions are sort of hitting her. For me, if there's kind of a thematic link to all the shows, I mean, we see in like the last 5 minutes of Egyptian Cigarettes, for example, is how people move past shame.
One of the most kind of liberating moments of my life was truly understanding the difference between guilt and shame, kind of understanding guilt as a check engine light, as an indicator for what I might be feeling and what I want more of, and that there's a path to finding that. Guilt can lead to kind of what I would say like loving practices of how to feel more of what you know you could have the potential to feel, you know, in a way that I think is brings us closer together. I think shame, you know, which is something that I realized I was mistaking for guilt, is truly just self-punishment and kind of making yourself feel like, yeah, that's it, you're done. And I think, again, a lot of the ways in which we practice modern religion, we kind of skip over all of the stuff about mercy and focus on the punishment stuff, which is very capitalist, because I think the more capitalist a society becomes, the more you also interpret religion that way, where you say, well, you did this, which equals negative, you know, sin equals money out of your bank account equals hell, right? It's so money-based. Do good, go to heaven, you know, so everything is framed in this really weird way. And so I think getting these characters to realize that they've been sitting under a blanket of shame, trying to get them to step out of shame and step into something more loving, is something that I think is very exciting for me as the show progresses too.
When I saw you and finally got a chance to meet you in person, I could tell you how excited I was, because this is such an enormous leap forward. And also it's about the confidence you have. I was talking about your confidence as an actor growing in this season, but also your confidence in storytelling has grown too, that each episode is in this way, this test that, again, to me feels like a cliffhanger. Like, what's going to be next for them?
It's a story that, you know, I think the way that we've been able to do it as a team, you know, I mean, it's not just me. It's like the way that we look at these stories and really interrogate them. Again, the more that we do it, the more that we feel confident about ways that we can craft it where, again, and it's not about, oh, we don't want people to get ahead of the story. It's more, we don't want to be precious with saving certain moments. We want to find the depth in everything that's in front of us. And so sometimes I think we get to certain things quicker and we draw out other things in different ways. And the more we've made the show, the more I've realized the types of plot moves or the types of moments character-wise that, again, have more meat than I might have usually thought. And in certain things that I think people might think are super big, that actually you just make that small, because we've seen a lot of that. And so I think the more we do it, the more we understand which parts of the story we're uniquely qualified to do within the framework of this show. And we try to focus on that even more.
It's a treatment. The show we're trying not to give away too much about is Rami. It's in its third season. It's star and creator and executive producer Rami Youssef is here with us. You can also hear this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. This thing you said during this Q&A we did not too long ago, which so neatly summarized the show for me, is that this character, Rami, is basically, when he leaves the United States and goes home, you would think he would be more gracious and more open to experience. But as you said, he's the consummate ugly American once he's away from America.
Very much. Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that that's what's interesting too, right? About the ways in which we define what it means to be an American. And I think that there are certain situations where you see him throughout this series or his family with a kind of suburby white New Jersey backdrop, and he really sticks out. But then you put him in a country with other Arabs, in a predominantly whether it be Arab or Muslim situation, and he still sticks out. And I think that's always been one of the things about the show that I think make it really funny. You know, there isn't this reprieve, there isn't this break. If anything, he looks closer to the thing he thought he was running away from than he wants to acknowledge. And I think that that's a very pressing kind of conversation with any diaspora culture. You know, what do you really take from the place that you've immigrated to, and what do you no longer have, or what is your actual lens? And so he's deeply American when we see him in Jerusalem. He's very American when we see him in Cairo. He's less like his counterparts than he'd like to be. So there's always this gap.
The way we're talking, people would think this show is not funny, and it's deeply funny. It's just playing at these contradictions and awareness or lack of awareness. And that awareness and or lack of awareness is really, again, thematically a big part of this third season too, which makes it, I think, the comedy that much richer, at least for me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we're definitely talking a lot about, you know, what the engine for the pressure is, you know, but I think all these things are what make it really funny for me. The pressure in and of itself is kind of a nuanced one. And I think crafting where that comes from is something that, yeah, I have a lot of fun doing. And I never thought that I would, you know, get to make an episode about trying to hook up with someone and being thwarted by an Israeli checkpoint or being thwarted by the time constraints of Ramadan. You know, those are things that had happened to me in real life before making the show. And I never realized how, you know, bizarrely funny they were. And I remember just talking to friends about it, and they were like, not only is that a crazy problem, I didn't even know that problem existed. And I think that that's the kind of thing that's really fun to do with this show.
What you've done so often before the show has always been about trying to offer a point of view that you haven't seen before. And that's clearly your ambition here, because there are tropes that we come to expect. And not only do you not touch on those tropes, you ask questions that nobody's bothered to ask, let alone answer before, in the context of a comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely certain things that, you know, we're constantly in a situation that of having to defend or having to say who we're not. You know, that tends to be kind of the olive branch of an explanation or a declaration. And definitely this is internal. We don't really deal with any sort of PR about who we want you to think we are in terms of, you know, this family at least, or in terms of any sort of Arab American Muslim experience. You know, there's a lot of hyphens to that. I'm not even talking about South Asian Americans or South Asian Brits. There are hyphens upon hyphens of how people live and what they do, and you can find it in any place and in any culture. And so I think that, again, this one's just very specific, and it's really about this fictional family and what's funny about the specific pressures that they're under. And so, yeah, we definitely, in terms of, you know, your question or observation, at least, of the what would be expected or what you might think, yeah, it's definitely not, it's not an explanation for our existence, because it I think the show presumes that we're way beyond trying to tell anybody, you know, that we're safe or anything like that. I almost feel like this show exists in a context of like 10 years from now, where no one even thinks bad things about Muslims, and you're just seeing our own specific tensions. And I think sometimes, because there isn't that gap and because there is so little about who we are, I'll get a little bit of heat from people who are hoping for something that feels a bit more like a sugar-coated olive branch of some sort. But yeah, just not exactly what I think I have to offer with this specific show.
It's the treatment. My guest, who's now sugar-coating olive branches, is Rami Yusuf. He's the star in Korea, Rami, now in his third season. Can we talk about this? I mean, there is this momentum of just the thrill of storytelling for you and being able to use these tools in a way that you clearly are still getting surprise and satisfaction from. And that's something I don't think I've ever seen or felt as often as I do when watching your show. And given how many different kinds of comedies there are on now, so many of them still at some point fall back on the, well, we want to congratulate the audience a little bit by just doing what you've done this season. Basically, at some point, upending the table on every single character that we think we know. Is that this also this ambition you this would need of how far into the corner can we paint ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because I think there was this thing at the end of season two where somebody was like, more than one person, but I guess there's like a notable writer that I kind of know had written something of just like, why would you do this to this character of Rami? You know, I really liked him. Why would you paint him into this corner? There's no way he can come back. And in my head, I was like, oh, he's not even as deep as I think we're going to take him. So I guess we lost you and that's fine. You know, I mean, I wasn't upset with that. And this was actually, you know, I talked about this a lot with one of my co-writers, Amir Suleiman, who's, a black Muslim, you know, and most Muslims in America are black and no one talks about that. And we were just kind of talking about whether it be an Arab character, or a black character. It's interesting sometimes with a white character and, you know, like a Walter White or something, you know, people are really willing to watch somebody devolve and look at that. And they kind of just say, wow, that person's complex. And then all of a sudden, the character becomes part of a less represented group, and we get a lot more precious about them being likable and them being good and them being, again, holding this olive branch in some certain way. And I think for me, it's the most healthy thing to do is just kind of completely reject those notions, but also understand that there are going to be some people who are just inherently not happy about that. And there's going to be some sort of colorblindness around why they're not happy with it. And even if they don't see it or if they don't say it. And that's not like a racist thing. That's like what I think is like self-censorship or kind of even what sometimes we'll call like, as we're talking about ideas, like self-colonizing, you know, where it's like, oh, no, I don't need anyone to put me in my place. I'll put myself in my place and I'll make sure I don't do too, you know, like, so I reject all of that. And I think that that's what makes it fun for me.
My guest who's rejected everything but comedy and the pursuit of that is Rami Youssef. His terrific show, Rami's in his third season. I can't thank you enough for doing this, and I hope you come back again. These times with you always go by so quick, and I can't thank you enough for your time, Rami. Thank you.
Thank you, Elvis. Always appreciate just the best questions in the biz.
The Emmy-nominated star and creator of the Hulu comedy series, Rami Youssef. The show, which is denser and more satisfying, is now in its third season. I hope you can stay with us for a conversation with Rebecca Miller, the screenwriter-director who's returned to an early love, writing short stories with the collection Total. If you can't stick with us, go to kcrw.com/thetreatment for that interview and past episodes. Writers are exercising their unique voices. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm not sure what to say about my guest. That hasn't been said in many better places. She's an actor. She is a writer-director. She is, I think, first and foremost, a terrific fiction writer. You may know her from the film Personal Velocity. Well, that was also an adaptation by herself of a group of short stories. She's returned to the short story form with Total. My guest is Rebecca Miller. It's so good to have you on the show, Rebecca. As you know, some of us were really big fans of your film, Personal Velocity.
Yes, I do. I remember us talking about it many years ago.
In reading Total and in the collection, it's fascinating because so many of these stories, there's kind of loosely linked by people's need to connect. And there's a kind of loneliness that sort of inhabits all these stories, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. There is a loneliness, and especially like the title story Total, but also like the Chekhovians and a bunch of the stories does have this kind of isolation of people. But the story happens because people are trying to connect, I think.
God, because as we were talking, I was just thinking about the first story, Mrs. Covet, which is so, I mean, it's got so many beautiful touches in it. I mean, just going from Petit Moore to the story being about pregnancy, sex, and death, because there's an animal death occurred. I mean, I just thought there's so much kind of incredible mirroring that goes on in this. And I'm just wondering, conceptually, if that was something that you wanted to put in all these stories, or if it's just something that happened and ended up being another kind of thematic link.
These stories were written over a really long period of time. So Mrs. Covet was written when I was actually breastfeeding a child who's now 20 years old. And then the stories were kind of written over periods of time when I was even writing other fiction, and then when I would be writing, making films. And yet I would write these stories. And in a way, I took the shorts, they were almost like my secret little guilty pleasure that I was doing for myself. And so they have a kind of very personal quality to them, almost like nobody was expecting anything of me. So I think a lot of my own private obsessions kind of leaked into the stories, and there is a kind of Hall of Mirrors quality of them. And there is a lot of the fear that comes with motherhood, as well as the intense joy and the general intensity of it. The idea of death sort of being lurking around is something that is in all the stories, I guess. That's a very big part of the collection. But it wasn't something I was doing so much like intentionally, because the stories were kind of coming of their own. And I was really into the idea of like kaleidoscoping time a lot and almost creating a novelistic feeling when you read the story, so that even if you're reading a 20-page story, you've kind of gone very deep into people's psyches and their pasts and stuff.
Yeah, you mentioned the Chekhovians, and there's a couple lines in there that really sort of struck me, and it's this need for release and kind of all these kind of emotions that well up. And I'll read it. It was like vomiting. For the first time since Teddy's death, Laura felt the grief rise up and crash out of her. And there are moments like that in almost each of these stories, so that sort of power, that almost being overwhelmed, emotion, feeling, just almost rising up to somebody's hairline, that I just found to be almost vertiginous in this.
I think so. And I think it's also kind of like connected to repression that, you know, in a lot of cases, the emotion has been repressed and then eventually there's a release. And sometimes it's quite dark. Like Mrs. Covet is somebody that works for this family and that everybody thinks is kind of a joke. And then secretly she's had this like these repressed needs for connection and love that she just can't control anymore. In a way, it makes her, you know, commit a criminal act. In the case of the Chekhovians, you know, where Laura, you know, nobody in the family can deal with her brother's death, and she's just been holding it inside her for so long until the point where she thinks there's something wrong with her and she can't feel anymore. And then finally she's released.
But also we're clearly aware of this passage of time that takes place in so many of the stories. I'm just thinking about how often we get a chance to see that. And how sort of ignoring something and not really paying attention to things as they're going on around you. I mean, even Mrs. Covet and your protagonist there has been sort of ignoring things for a while. And we also get a sense of her having been ignored by her mother-in-law. And that just, again, that sort of that disconnectedness that creates this sort of, I think, this kind of anxiety, almost a sense of dread that moves us from one story to another.
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, because sometimes talking the truth and really being open is so painful. I think that there is a sense that people are almost protecting each other from talking about things. Like in Total, you know, where it's the only futuristic story, slightly futuristic story in the collection. And there's these children with a syndrome been born because of the Total phone. But the family, within the family, nobody can talk about the fact that there's a Total in the family. And the mother had something to do with the invention of the phone. And without the repression, there wouldn't be a story in a way.
But also, again, as you're saying, that mother being kind of this engine of the Total phone. I mean, we have to get into it a little bit to sort of see exactly how she's complicit in this thing that's changed society. I mean, it's so fascinating because there's this sort of constant sort of back and forth dialogue the characters are having with themselves. And even the ones that there's a more omniscient narrator, we still get that sense, don't we?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to me, like how inner dialogue and how we talk to ourselves and the stories we tell ourselves cause action, you know? Like, even before I was officially, like, writing short stories, I used to write stories to tell me what the plots of my short films could be because I couldn't figure out what people would do unless I knew what they were thinking. And then later it occurred to me that here I was writing all this stuff and I never thought of publishing it, but that maybe that would be worthy of being published, you know? So in a way, that thing of, like, what people think, what's going on behind them, their eyes, is so interesting to me, and how it causes, you know, action or inaction, which then later causes a kind of action, you know?
As I was reading it, and as you were talking here too, that sounds almost like an actor's tool of sort of, you know, crafting and constructing sort of backstory so you understand the things that aren't being said.
I mean, I don't think it's too much to say that all novelists to some degree have to be actors in their own heads because they're being these people, you know, and you're making these big stretches of trying to imagine yourself into these characters who are really not you and who have different experiences. And so in a way, there's a dramatist and an actor within any person writing fiction. I think if you're going to have real characters that you really honor and that are complete. So you do have to get in there and laugh with them and kind of cry with them and feel with them, I think. And that is, anyway, my experience is that I go very deep into the narratives and sort of like wear them like a fleshy coat while I'm writing.
There's this thing that I feel in your work, certainly I felt it in Pippoli and in both the short stories of Personal Velocity in the film and in this, that distance that sometimes the characters don't recognize between their perception of the world and the way they're explaining it. There's so much drama in that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it goes back to like Dostoevsky and the Underground Man, you know, like what's going on inside a person versus what other people think is going on. And there is never a complete confluence of those two things, I don't think, ever, because it can't be. And that's the strangeness of consciousness and being a person, you know. It's just like you can't, you know, completely align your inner life with outer life. And I think some people are really distant from reality or And then, you know, of course, you have to ask what is reality. But to some degree, everybody has a kind of mad discourse going on inside their heads. I mean, like, you know, Daphne in the first story is a perfectly normal person, maybe a little bit absent-minded, but she's within the realm of normal. But yet she has this kind of far-reaching dialogue that's just so, you know, she has so many thoughts and they just come out in a torrent. And a lot of them are kind of wacky in a certain way. And I think that's just true of people. And that makes, I think probably my motivation really is in general is how interested I am in people.
I can feel this affection and empathy for these characters. You were talking about Daphne and there's a torrent that happens the night after something has happened. I don't want to give too much away where she's watching. She falls asleep and she's dreaming about being sort of swarmed by ladybugs. And then she turns on the TV and sees this hysteria that could almost be out of a dream. And then there's that sort of torrent that comes out of I Want You to Know, where Trevor's mother is meeting Jode, and all these words just kind of rush out of her and opening that sort of floodgate of repression that you were talking about happens at these moments that become these kind of fascinating flashpoints where we almost get this sense of sometimes characters getting too close, either figuratively or literally, to other people.
Even people who are living together and aligned, like her, Jode and her husband, who are, you know, they're farming, organic farmers, they're doing everything together. And yet they're, I guess, prisoners of, I mean, she is certainly of her own imagination. Like she's a little out of step with her life and her relationship. Even if she's happy in the relationship, she's kind of alien to it. And then, you know, of course, comes this monstrous letter that she finds in this piece of furniture that she's renovating. And then, you know, that's in a way like the most terrifying thing that you could find of somebody's inner life that she finds.
No, I mean, that there's a piece of information that comes out like that often enough in these stories. I thought you could have called this collection the Chekhovians, because
interesting. I think you're right. I mean, I think I did think about actually that as a title, and I ended up feeling like Total was perhaps spoke, I guess, to the aspect of mothering and the mother-child bond, which is so redolent in a lot of the stories, that kind of I felt like I went with that as a kind of idea of the totality of that, as well as, of course, the Total Phone and the central story. But I think you're right. It could have also been called the Chekhovians. And Chekhov has been a huge influence on me. I haven't acted for some time, but early on, I was in Peter Brook's production of The Cherry Orchard in the 80s, and I played Anya. And I played that at BAM in New York, and then in Brooklyn, and then in Japan, and all over what was then the Soviet Union. It was just starting to break up. And the experience of being in that play and watching it every night from backstage, and just like that, just that whole experience was so formative to me.
It's hard to talk about these stories without giving too much away, which I really don't want to do, because there's a wonderful kind of surprise that happens in every single one of them that also feels like it's the thing that links them to me. There's a moment that comes out of nowhere, that seemingly comes out of nowhere, that defines the entire story. As long as we're talking about these things that are thematic links, I just wonder if that was something you were consciously working toward too, as you were saying, you just found as you were cobbling these stories together while engaged in other pursuits.
To be clear, like when I was writing the stories, I was utterly engaged in writing the stories, but then I would do something else. And in a way, because they were written, almost, it was almost like, I don't know, having an affair with my short story or something. Like I would go off and like have a little quiet secret write. But they were written in a spirit of some unconsciousness. One of the things that's kind of very unusual about this collection is that a few of them I tried to write much earlier. Like the story Vapors, I started to try to write that actually even earlier. I mean, really early, like many years ago, 25 years ago, let's say, even, you know, when I was starting out, I didn't know how to tell the story of this moment when a woman, you know, just this kind of crisis moment in a woman's life and between various different lovers and kind of trying to figure out her life. And it was only in the pandemic when I had the time and I was sitting there and I could really devote myself, I sort of cracked it. And I figured out a frame for Vapors. And I realized that she had to meet, you know, the worst boyfriend she'd ever have in order to kind of open this floodgate of memory and so on. So that was an example. The other one was Receipts, that I had the center of the story, but I could not figure out, I couldn't really hear the character. Then gradually she came to me, you know, because sometimes you just have to wait to hear the voice until you can hear the voice. Like I have to wait, and then I'm waiting and I hear the voice, and then I can start writing in the voice.
I'm glad you mentioned Vapors, because that's actually my favorite story of the group. Talking about this sort of Chekhovian thing of the past, and the past really inhabits every room in which she spends time. And it actually has one of my favorite lines in the book. She had been bad and traitorous and bad, and she didn't know why. And that's something that a very young person would say. I mean, that repetition of the word bad. And as you were talking about this, oh, yeah, I see what you needed a little more time to have a little more perspective on it, but she's still sort of caught up in emotions that are inchoate than the way that they would be for a younger person. Again, the past is a shadow that never goes away in that.
In some ways, it's deformed her life, but it's also formed her life and kind of like given her to herself. In a weird way, the story of the stories is me having developed as a person and a writer over a long period of time. But the trick was, like you said, to preserve in a way the naivete of the early self, you know, that you don't get rid of that while you're trying to formally make sense of the story and find a structure. I'm very into, you know, quietly complex structure that isn't obviously complex, but where the bottom keeps dropping out of the narrative. Like Personal Velocity was structured that way in the film. You know, there's a bottom and it falls out and you're down in another floor of the past, and then then the bottom of that falls out. Then you find yourself. So it's kind of like, how do you stay coherent, but yet you're guiding people through this hall of mirrors of somebody's past? and yet, you know, keeping it entertaining.
But as with personal velocity, we're aware of where we are at each stage of somebody's life. And there's a bigger panoply of that kind of thing going on here, which I thought is kind of great, too.
You know, in the end, there's a kind of desire for mercy, I think, in the thing. Because there's a lot of sin and a lot of, I mean, sin might be the wrong word, but a lot of bad things are done. and like people doing things that they wish they hadn't done. Or, I don't know, I ended up feeling very kind of affectionate toward the characters. And I guess in the end, I can't really write people unless I love them in some way. Even the people who are doing the worst things.
Is that true? Do you find that was happening here as well? Because there are some moments that are really kind of tough to deal with. I mean, a lot of stuff that Laura goes through, but I was also thinking about Total, which is really, it crams an enormously sort of evolved emotional narrative into a story. I mean, you're talking about complication, and there's so much going on in that. And I just wonder if you liked everybody in that.
Yeah, I do, I think. I can empathize with them. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily like them in the sense that, like, oh, I want to hang out with you if I were. but no, I think I do. Like, even, like, Roxanne's mother, who's definitely a strange character and a difficult character, I understand her and I feel for her because she unlocked something that she can never take back. Like, she helped discover a phone that created all these toxic births, including her own. And now she has to deal with this. And she so wishes it would go away, you know? And I think the impulse toward denial is a really powerful human emotion too. Like, it's almost like an unemotion, but it definitely, I think, counts in terms of how people exist in the world. So, but yeah, I think I do really feel for all these people. I think the longer you're in the world and the more mistakes you make, the more you can feel for other people who are making mistakes. That's how I just...
It's the treatment. We're talking denial with my guest, writer, director, and author now, Rebecca Miller, whose new collection of stories is Total. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But there is this moment of a female character regarding somebody older than herself. We see that mirroring there too. And that kind of mirroring happens so often that it becomes this really kind of satisfying thing that to me is sort of this frame that clearly some part of you was always thinking about.
I think that's probably really true. And I think that in my own experience, that has been true of experiencing other women older than me and then having other people experience me and watch and try and figure each other out in some way. There's also the sense of a chasm too, though. I also think that a huge part of the collection, which I sort of touched on a little bit, was the idea of the mother-child bond and like the dark side of that and also the beauty of it, but the intensity of it, you know, and just the totalic nature of it. The sense of like no escape that you get from, I think, these stories, this sort of sense of that the mother-child, it's kind of like a finger trap, you know, you try and pull away, but it just holds on to you tighter. You know, like in Total, like she's repelled by her mother, but also she kind of mirrors her mother. I mean, that's kind of the clearest.
Exactly.
Yeah, that moment when they're sitting on the bed. Yeah. And she looks at the mirror and there they are. Yeah.
Yeah, the moments like that happen so often. But I just found too, and I want to ask you about the ordering of the stories, because each story seems to get in some way kind of bigger, like a bigger cast of characters. So by the time we end up, the Chekhovians, and it really is like watching people almost making entrances in and out of the narrative. And I just wonder if that was something you were working towards too, trying to make each, in a way, feel slightly bigger than what had come before it.
I definitely get the feeling like with the choice of Mrs. Covey, because it's also such a relatable story and it's kind of funny. And I thought that that was a nice way to, you know, to start it. I don't think I even realized how dark Mrs. Covey was until I started to talk to people about it. And then I realized,
really?
Of course, there is
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like, I think, you know, speaking of like not having very good self-perception, I think sometimes I think I think things are just sort of funny and light, and then they're actually horrifying. But
oh my gosh, the moment where her mother-in-law comes in and she looks at her mother-in-law and just says she never left the house ever looking like this. Oh my God. Again, a woman seeing herself measuring against another woman, and just what that, even that inner dialogue that goes, be it, you know, from a first person or an omniscient narrator. I mean, that happens so often. You didn't think that was dark? I mean, that moment alone, before it goes any further.
No, like, I didn't. I really didn't. I mean, and then, you know, the other things are like, that's nothing compared to what else happens. But I just thought of it as lighter, I think. I think that in a way I thought.
Well, it's certainly the lightest story in the book. I will give you that.
Yes, thank you. At least I have that. I guess also Total I thought of as the centerpiece because it's sort of a little bit of its own. Like it's its own kind of story and it has this futuristic element to it. So I thought that should go in the middle. And then the Chekhovians, I wanted to end with the Chekhovians, like you said, because it does have a kind of bigness to it in terms of the cast of characters and also just the end of it. I like the idea of ending with Lara, who I actually, like if there was any of these characters I was going to like maybe would be interested in like writing a novel about, it would actually be Lara. I think she's a really interesting character. I'd love to know what happens to her later.
The interest that the story itself kind of has in her and just attempting to hold on, you know, I mean, I use the word vertiginous when we first started talking. That's a real sense that I got from reading the Chekhovians. And just there's a kind of scale to it. Almost a sense of her white knuckling her way through her life that becomes evident as we read more of the story.
Yes, and I think that with Lara, which is true of some of the other young characters, she's only 14, but she's somebody who feels very much on her own as a child observing adults being so unable to control their own lives. Like, she realizes that she's alone. That to me is very moving. The young person who realizes that they're really on their own because adults are just, they look like adults, but they're actually lost. It's just something that I tend to return to a lot.
I was wondering, and you brought it up as a novel, if you'd ever thought about doing it as a novel, just because there's such a sense of scale and the story doesn't exactly end. And I'm not going to give too much away by saying that.
No, it's true. I mean, no, I have. It has been kind of haunting me a little bit because I tend to work very unconsciously. Things just sort of like marinate. But I just have this feeling with that particular story that and that particular person that maybe there's something more or that, you know, I'd like to know what happens later because the way she thinks and her particular way of being as a person is kind of original. And I really love her. There were a couple of the stories that I actually considered, are they novels, are they stories? Like Total was another one. But then I thought, no, Total has to be a story because I had to have it be telegraphic almost. Like the style is very spare and very boiled down. And if you start trying to flesh everything out, I felt like the magic might go out of it. Because I really think of short stories as kind of like, you can do something in short stories that you can't do, and I don't think, in a novel exactly, which is that they're have a mystical component where like they kind of lift off the ground if they work. So I thought that I couldn't have that with, I just wanted that with Total and I didn't know if I could get it, if it was a novel.
Well, that's probably a good place to end. My guest who doesn't realize how dark she can be sometimes apparently is Rebecca Miller. Her new collection of short stories, and let's welcome her back, is the collection entitled Total. Rebecca, what a pleasure to talk to you and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Total, the collection of short stories by the multi-talented writer Rebecca Miller, who's also a screenwriter and director. Next is The Treat on a writer whose ability to pick comedy, melodrama, and athletes. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. And it's John Hamm with The Treat. The star of the adaptation of Confess Fletch on a writer who creates the world according to his own house rules.
Hi, I'm John Hamm, and this is The Treat.
All these things are ghosts and dreams in the world according to God.
Given the fact that I'm in a movie called Confess Fletch, which is rebooting the Fletch franchise based on books written in the 70s, 80s by Gregory MacDonald. I'll bring it back to good old fashioned books. And my treat for me and is and has been reading the works of one John Irving, starting with The Hotel New Hampshire, moving through The World According to Garp, and finishing with A Prayer for Owen Meany.
But hopes and schemes are ghosts and dreams in the world according to Garp.
Garp got the right tone and had the right actor in the middle of it. Well, two of the right actors. Lithgow and Robin Williams were phenomenal in them. Unclose as well.
My name's Roberta.
I'm Garp.
You're Jenny's son.
Yes, I am.
Oh, I just finished reading your novel. I think it's wonderful.
Any John Irving stories really have to have the right tone. And I think, you know, when you see The World According to Garp, directed by one George Roy Hill, there is a very, very talented man at the helm, keeping his hand on the tiller and steering it away from sentimentality or what have you.
I always wanted a child. I could have had one by myself, I would have, but God or nature or whatever. Well, you know, you need a man. You know what men are like, full of lust. I can talk to you because you're past all that.
What?
There's a lot of kind of mysticism in that and almost magical realism in that, and I think that having a good sense of imagination and wonder about the absurdity of life, which also very much are things that John Irving gets into, is a pretty good prerequisite for wanting to be an actor.
It's a restless world and the lips are curled as the hands come reaching your way. But the writer's pen simply moves again and puts it down on the page. On any stretch.
The Treat. Actor John Hamm on writer John Irving. The Treatment is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. The show is mixed by Katie Gilchrist with help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan. Next, The World of Music, according to Chris DeRuytis, hoping for When I'm 64, as used in that John Irving film adaptation. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.